Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to John Preuss, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Dayton, about his new book, The Mass Appeal of Human Rights. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
This is a great book, and it's so, so well-timed. I mean, in the States, you've got a really high-profile discussion about kind of branding and, you know, politics, human rights issues with Nike at the moment. And the book is, you know, really kind of timely in terms of giving a background and allowing us to think sort of critically. I guess the place to start might be, I mean, did you feel this stuff was kind of in the air, you know, as you were writing it? Or, you know, was it a kind of a case of just, you know, lucky timing that our current moment has intersected with your kind of broader intellectual agenda?
Thank you for saying that and for framing it that way. I felt as though, you know, the initial impetus for the book was observations of things that were right in front of me, and not in front of me as an academic or a scholar, but really in front of all of us. And I think if there's anything that's appealing or attractive about this book is the fact that these are sort of cases and examples and scenarios that we all recognize. You know, we see celebrities in human rights marketing, and we see, you know, marketing adopt, as you have already suggested, marketing adopt a human rights lens, or at least, you know, some form of sort of a sense of activism or protest, you know, in the Nike and Colin Kaepernick example. And so what I did, as I was observing these things around us, I tried to trace it back and see sort of what the lineage of these practices was. How did it emerge? Why? At what time? And how has it changed over that time? And you know, what's interesting, and I write about this in the preface, is that one of the reviews that I got towards the end of the process was really about, you know, whether or not this idea of particularly a transnational, you know, human rights advocacy, whether or not that in itself is a thing of the past. So on the one hand, surely the mashup between, you know, politics and protest and commercialism is ongoing. But the idea that these big, you know, major transnational NGOs, non-governmental organizations, can or will still operate in this way in an era of retrenchment, of global retrenchment, of nationalism and all these things, really made me think whether or not what I've captured here is a bit of a time capsule. You know, it's a bit of a snapshot of something that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. Of course, we don't know yet, but it is curious to see whether, you know, walls and borders and nationalism will have an impact on how transnational advocacy takes shape in the future. So I think it's a little bit of both. There was definitely a lot of looking backward as well as sort of observing what was going on around us. If it's relevant today, then I would expect that's as much a stroke of luck as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, the examples in the book, I think, are so illustrative of that. You know, I mean, we'll maybe talk later about Live Aid and Live 8, and, you know, very, very much a different global context, particularly obviously with the Trump administration in the US having, you know, an explicitly kind of nationalist or anti-globalist, depending on which language you're using, agenda. But I guess before we dive into the specific examples, we probably need to do a couple of things. And the first thing is maybe kind of draw out the book's central tension, which unusually we might do by discussing Paris Hilton. So, you know, but Paris Hilton opens the book, and she is a really good example of the central tension, as the book describes, between, I guess, kind of, you know, consumer culture, as we've mentioned, and human rights more generally. So, you know, tell me about Paris.
Right. Well, Paris Hilton is obviously an extreme example. But the anecdote that opens the book begins with the subject line of an email that pairs Paris Hilton with Elie Wiesel, the, you know, Nobel laureate and survivor of Auschwitz and anti-genocide crusader. And you know, it does, I hope, establish a central tension in the book, which is this this uncomfortable relationship between something that is so severe and so serious, that is human suffering and violations of human dignity and how it makes us feel and what we want to do about it, with this you know, quite vapid personality that Paris Hilton cultivates for herself around, surely around seduction and around sex appeal and around her, you know, herself being a fashion icon, very closely tied to a whole range of different examples of consumerism. And so, and I remember very well receiving this email thinking, this is odd. And what is it really, you know, evidence about the efforts that human rights advocates will go to attract an audience? And that this pairing of Elie Wiesel and Paris Hilton might be something that would occur to someone and say, this is a good idea, and this raises no flags, to me is a red flag. It suggests that something has gone off the rails. You know, something is headed in a direction that I don't recognize. And so that surely, you know, drove me to look back and say, well, how did we get to this? And you know, and throughout, you know, the question of celebrity, of course, continues to you know, pop up in various chapters. And again, Paris Hilton is an extreme example, because of I think how silly her persona is or was at the time, and she's hardly in the headlines like she was 10 years ago. But so that I think sort of frames the central tension in the book, this idea that human rights is something serious, something severe, and consumerism tends to entertain us, to seduce us in a way that frankly made me uncomfortable.
And how do we get here? Because obviously, I mean, I'm sort of in my mid-30s, and for me, celebrity has always been bound up with human rights. You know, it's been sort of for as long as I can remember, you know, growing up. In fact, some of the examples in the book were things that framed my youth. But this wasn't always the case. And you draw in particular on, I guess, kind of a critical tradition in human rights study to say, actually, this is something, you know, comparatively sort of new, and we need to think about it in a historical context and ask, how do we get here?
So I think the longest historical vantage needs to recognize that this has been around in some form for quite a long time. pardon me. We could go back to the Free Congo movement, or the Congo Reform movement of the late 19th century, where Mark Twain and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle famously write and advocate for, you know, an end to the personal colony of King Leopold II of Belgium. You know, Mark Twain writes King Leopold's Soliloquy, this satire from the perspective of King Leopold. And that, in a sense, is a kind of celebrity. I mean, he, you know, both Mark Twain and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle were approached and approached the movement. It came in both directions to lend their status and their own visibility to the movement. And surely that's been the case throughout. And, you know, I talk periodically about, you know, other times that this has popped up in history around the Vietnam War, surely, the Biafra in the late 60s, the Beatles did, sit-ins and all the rest, for the suffering and the starvation in Biafra. And so this has something that has been a part of our international politics for quite a long time, I would say. But I still do think that something here is different. I think that something here has changed. And I think what's happened here has been this collapse, this sort of flattening of the space between entertainment and politics, so much so that today it is not only advocacy organizations who will seek out celebrity spokespersons to represent them, to raise their profile, to raise money, surely, to use their status to access decision makers, as well as to access the audience, the public. But it also flows very, very specifically in the other direction, in which having a humanitarian cause has become as much a part of the celebrity profile as a new movie or a new album or a new commercial, you know. And there are firms that celebrities seek out and consult with to say, what cause it best suits the profile that I am trying to project, right? So this idea that human rights, humanitarianism, you know, some form of humanistic politics, is itself a component of celebrity lifestyle. And I think, you know, particularly as the book goes on, we talk about, you know, Save Darfur and merchandising and all these ways, the way that human rights advocacy has been folded into a life as a lifestyle component of even every of everyday, you know, average individuals is very much mirrored in the celebrity ranks as well.
That flattening you describe between celebrity and politics beautifully sets up the key sort of theoretical engagement that's in the book, which is with the ideas of the Frankfurt School. You know, and their longstanding criticism to things like consumer capitalism, of, you know, the sort of role of particular kinds of ideology, and I guess a sketch of why they matter to the analysis might set us up for what comes as a, I guess, a kind of critical theory take on things like Amnesty, Live Aid, on, you know, Save Darfur and this kind of stuff. So yeah, why were the Frankfurt School, I guess, kind of important, and why were you drawn to them?
So, you know, as a student of political theory, the Frankfurt School just always turned me on, frankly. It always sort of captured my imagination, but more than imagination, it seemed to distill the life, the world that I was seeing, and put it into a language that made sense of the things that I was seeing. So maybe that's a bit of a selection bias, but it resonated with me, and it helped me understand, and then helped me describe the world that I was living in, and the world that we were living in, and tensions of commercialism, the weakness of mass politics and organized politics and grassroots politics. And so, you know, thinking again, you know, obviously the critiques of the Frankfurt School in the dilution and the marginalization of the working class of leftist movements, you know, through the 1960s, I connect to human rights in as much as human rights to me is an heir of a kind of internationalism that has a progressive vision that is, again, rooted in individual dignity and autonomy and a sense of freedom that I think the Frankfurt School critique helps describe equally well. It's not rooted, I mean, human rights politics is not rooted in the kind of materialism that a leftist politics is, but I think that the shape that, you know, human rights movements, mass human rights movements, transnational human rights movements have taken can be equally well explained, you know, by the ways that they've integrated and they've integrated consumerism and have been shaped by consumer capitalism in the same ways that Marcuse or Adorno describe the effect of those forces on working class mobilization as well. And so that's sort of that's a leap, I think. And I wonder how that sits with people, because you know, I when I think of the legacy of human rights, I see a radical legacy. I see a legacy that stretches back across, you know, direct action, grassroots movements that challenge the arbitrary exercise of power and center, you know, human dignity in a way that is quite radical. And so I think the watered down version that we get in these mass campaigns that I describe are a result of the integration of consumerism and human rights, if that makes sense.
I mean, the really easy way to kind of, I guess, further justify, or, you know, to illustrate what you're saying, if people might have a bit of skepticism, is with your critical theory reading of the history of Amnesty International. And I think we might spend a little bit of time on that, because it's such a, you know, sort of a clear example, particularly of, I guess, how Amnesty changed over time in terms of, as you've identified, that consumerist and celebrity element.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so the story that I identified that I think gives birth to the model of transnational advocacy that we see is a very sort of, you know, emerges out of a very pure financial need. Amnesty International, you know, is created or founded in 1961, the 1960s, by Peter Benenson in London, and it's, you know, Rise is described better than in my book by Stephen Hopgood in Keepers of the Flame, who I think really, you know, lays out the ethos and the you know, the fabric of Amnesty International very nicely in that book, which I've always quite liked. And as Amnesty grows in the 60s, it establishes national chapters across Europe and in North America. In the 70s, it spreads further. It expands on its work, including opening a national chapter in the Soviet Union, and it sees its membership really explode in a very profound way. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of members, of paid, dues-paying members across the world of this international human rights organization. Something, you know, a development that cannot be overstated, how monumental that sort of a development is. But it also exposes, you know, the constraints of its model of a deeply decentralized funding and centralized efforts in terms of centralized work in terms of research and you know, campaign work, political prisoners and the adoption of political prisoners by local chapters, et cetera. It just places enormous strains on the International Secretariat of Amnesty International. And so there's a moment, and this is again in the context by the mid-70s of recession and economic downturn, where Amnesty is on the verge of bankruptcy. And, you know, national chapters and, you know, the archives are kind of, cute about the ways that various national chapters and local chapters, national sections and local chapters, the lengths they go to raise money, selling cups of soup on the street corner or having bake sales or, you know, very sort of, you know, very low level opportunities at raising low levels of money. And in the UK, one of the officers in the secretariat comes to be aware of the fact that John Cleese of the Monty Python's Flying Circus is a supporter, and John Cleese is approached with a proposal or with a suggestion that they do some sort of a benefit event. And so, out of this sort of need, I think John Cleese had given a donation, and they noticed John Cleese's name on the check, so they approached him about having a greater role in raising money. And so, out of this interaction, out of this exchange, is born the Secret Policeman's Ball, which becomes a string of comedy concerts, and that also begins to integrate music by the 80s, and that becomes sort of much larger concert events that are international as well as in the U.S. by the mid to late 80s. And so, Live Aid that would follow this model, and not only follow accidentally, but have a direct connection in the artists that perform and including in some of the organizers. So Sir Bob Geldof was an audience member and obviously a peer of Bono and Sting and all of these, Phil Collins, all these people who had become synonymous with Live Aid and with this form of, you know, human rights, humanitarian benefit concert. And I think it's honest enough, it's pure enough, it's genuine enough. But I think a critical perspective must insist that it leads us down a path that becomes difficult to unravel, right? That it becomes difficult to slow down to undo. And so that's that, you know, so the Amnesty International at that moment taking on this form gives rise to this model that is now the model. So, you know, Live Aid in 1984, 85, you know, is then followed on by Live 8, 25, 30 years later. It's just a very routinized go-to sort of a model for raising money, raising awareness. Anytime any kind of crisis emerges, a natural disaster, a famine of some kind, or a war. And so, you know, I hope that this sort of, you know, sheds some light on the origins of this model that we all know very well.
I still got the impression reading the book that you were, I don't want to go too far with this, but, you know, perhaps more sympathetic to Amnesty than you were to, as you say, the kind of the routine of Live 8, you know, and you sort of draw on Mark Hughes, you know, with the sense of a one-dimensional benefit concert. And I guess this kind of critique sort of gathers pace as you bring in this idea of a media spectacle, you know, things that are done essentially in a kind of attention-grabbing, attention economy sort of way. And I guess it'd be interesting to unpack that, maybe with the example of Somalia, but, you know, primarily through the nexus of how reporting, grabbing attention, and this, you know, kind of broader idea about spectacle has accelerated some of the things that you were, you know, kind of cautiously critiquing with Amnesty.
So I'm going to stick with the Amnesty example before we move on to Somalia, because I think that you raised something that's important and something that I struggle with, frankly. I'd be curious to know how you think about this. I am sympathetic to Amnesty International. It's sort of it was my introduction to the human rights movement as a high schooler, and through college, and it always sort of represented to me something very powerful, something that was very local. You know, something that was rooted in ordinary people sitting around a table writing letters, you know, in a church basement or in a high school classroom or on a college campus, writing letters for a political prisoner somewhere just to let them know that they weren't forgotten. Like, that to me is a very profound and very genuine sentiment and very humane. You know, it really, I think, speaks to an aspect of what human rights is. It's about being humane. It's about respecting people. It's about rights, and it's about law, and it's about political pressure. It's all those things, but it's also, you know, I think at its base, about humanity and writing letters to someone that you don't know who's in prison for something they believe in is, you know, among the most genuine gestures. And it is grassroots in the sense that, you know, it requires people to start their own chapters and to be involved on their own terms and purely voluntarily, and so there is a kind of innocence to it. I don't know if that's fair or not to characterize it that way. There's a kind of innocence to Amnesty that does provoke my sympathy, and I'm sure that comes through in the book. As much as I may have tried to hide it, or maybe I didn't, I don't know. And so, I mean, I think surely by the end of the book, I'm a little bit more critical of the arc, and we can get to that, I think.
Yeah, but by the time you're talking about Madonna, it's clear that something has gone very wrong in terms of this.
I do feel that way. Yeah, I do feel that way. I mean, and I think that, you know, so in the chapter where we talk about benefit concerts and that model that sort of links the John Cleese to the Bob Geldof phenomenon, I mean, there's something that is far more overtly political, rooted in the ethos of Amnesty International, that is clearly not there in the famine relief campaigns of Live Aid and We Are the World and all the rest. The politics clearly drops out by time the model is adopted by the anti-famine campaigns, in a way that I do feel is very different. So, you know, Amnesty International has a complicated relationship to politics as such. You know, clearly it is a political act to write a letter to a foreign head of state and demand that policies be changed. That inherently is political. Yet, Amnesty International retains this sort of apolitical or you know, non-political or at least non-partisan sort of an approach that, you know, that permits it to be. Make political claims without taking sides, right? These are the sort of lines that it straddles, and so there's a sympathy that I think if it builds, it builds in its critical capacity. But I also do think that, you know, the model was born out of a very genuine sort of, you know, cash-strapped moment, without anticipation for how it might evolve.
This isn't the case with Save Darfur. And, you know, what becomes effectively, I suppose, that you're most critical in the book, you know, an exercise in kind of merchandising and you know, branding and back to, you know, celebrity as well, with little of that grassroots political engagement, or even actually the broader money raising and kind of, you know, awareness raising of the famine campaigns.
I think that's true. I think that there was something about Save Darfur that really crystallized. I mean, it really felt like a culmination of all the things that had come before it. So it was the engagement with celebrity. It was the engagement with the entertainment. It was the attractiveness of human rights, and in this case, genocide prevention, as a component of a contemporary lifestyle. It was something to be expressed on a bumper sticker or a rubber wristband, or the sort of absurd extent to the merchandising. It was a dog, your dog could eat food out of a Save Darfur branded bowl, and there were underpants and all sorts of other silly integrations into pop culture that just border literally on the absurd, and with no grassroots in engagement. And so it became this sort of this facade of mass engagement, but the political efforts underway were purely elite. The advocacy efforts and the political pressure against the Bush administration were engaged at elite levels without any specific political actions by the supporters. And for Save Darfur, for me, the way I'd read it, this was all intentional. This wasn't an accident. They engage in high levels of advertising, and they literally employ firms whose other clients are Kentucky Fried Chicken and Pepsi Cola and so to see this, the way in which human rights branding can slide so seamlessly between the sort of corporate and the political, to me, again, is another very, I hope, very clear example of this collapse, of this, the way in which, the corporate, the commercial, and the political have folded into one another in a way that makes the political, frankly, just unrecognizable.
I mean, I picked this comment out from the concluding parts of the book in particular, because I was so struck by it, with Madonna talking about Pussy Riot, who, are involved in being imprisoned and, campaigns for human rights in Russia, and Madonna referring to them as, her fellow freedom fighters. Now, Madonna is important in a lot of kind of complex cultural studies ways, but freedom fighter wouldn't have been, the kind of phrase I'd point to when thinking about her. And I guess there's maybe two things that flow from that. One is, are we at now a phase where, and you alluded to this at the start, where there's nothing to be redeemed at all from these human rights campaigns, because they are just, methods of either elites or individual celebrities to kind of brand themselves. But actually, the kind of second part of that, is there something we can salvage? Is there still something of that original sort of amnesty set of practices that is resistant to modernity, a dialectic of enlightenment, a one-dimensional approach, as you identify in the book?
Yeah, well, I surely hope so. I'm not a fatalist when it comes to these things, even if I'm a skeptic. And so, with respect to this is again, this bringing human rights home is another concert event that Amnesty International holds that, is very self-consciously a reimagining. I mean, if it's reimagined, it's at least a repurposing of these concerts that Amnesty held in the late 80s, both around the United States and later in 1988 around the world. And Pussy Riot, of course, was very of the moment, having been, imprisoned by Putin, and they themselves are very radical, very much, in the spirit of a Guy Debord, of a sort of utilizing public spectacle as a disrupting cultural event, right? And so the videos and the things that they would stage, the protests that they would stage, would be an attempt to bring some of the social tensions to a fold, whether it was around consumerism or about around politics or et cetera. And so for me, this was a bad example. Well, a good example of a bad trend here, in which the, you know, Amnesty International was seeking to capitalize on the radical cachet of Pussy Riot without taking seriously the sort of the threat that they pose to Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, in a very specific kind of way, to have drawn his ire, and, you know, even more recently, very recently, a member of their collective was poisoned. I mean, they're clearly a very significant thorn in the side of that regime, that administration. And so, yeah, and Madonna does have a cultural, an important cultural role when it comes to, you know, sexual revolution and feminism and all the rest, which is not to be ignored or overlooked. But it did feel as though in this moment, and in the broader sort of tour that Pussy Riot did of the United States after they were released from prison, that they were trotted out onto stage. And this is taking their agency away from them. And I don't mean to do that. I do, though, mean to focus on the way in which they are utilized by a major NGO like Amnesty International in a way that it is not maybe exploitative is overstated. I don't know. That feels exploitative. It feels like they were brought out to say, look how radical we are, Pussy Riot's here with the balaclavas and the prison time and all of this other, you know, all this other sort of you know, stuff that they bring with them. And so I don't think that this is a, you know, I don't think this is a nail in the coffin. I don't think this is the final signal that, you know, transnational human rights is dead or sort of beyond repair. You know, I don't make too many, I don't hide my sort of, you know, my commitment in a certain way to improving and reclaiming or rescuing or whatever we want to say the merit of human rights as a valuable framework for articulating, you know, claims around justice and fairness and dignity and equality. I am deeply troubled by the shape that these campaigns take and the associations that the broader audience has with human rights as a product of it.
Concluding question is always a sort of what comes next for the author. And I just wonder, actually, you know, is this a kind of moment for you to have settled accounts to an extent with human rights and to move on to a different subject? Or actually, you know, are you going to kind of do more work? I mean, particularly perhaps practical work, actually, given the context in which the book finds itself.
Yeah, I mean, so... You know, I think, and I tease this out somewhat in chapter one too. I think there's, you know, in a lot of the critiques of human rights that have emerged, there's this. I think it ends up being more of a subtext. There's a subtext or a subterranean sort of desire for or a yearning for human rights to be something other than what it is now. And I think that other than is not clearly articulated in many other critiques. And I don't know if mine is, but I've been thinking a lot about it since the book came out. What we want or expect from human rights is something other than this shallow, commercial, elite sort of falseness that we see when we look at the things that I describe in the book. What we want is something deeper, profound, personal, sustained, solidaristic, right? Rooted in solidarity, rather than sort of superficiality or indulgence or you know, self-satisfaction. And I think that in the critiques, and I include, and I mention, you know, Stephen Hopgood in The End Times of Human Rights, and Lily Chuliaraki in her work around Ironic Spectator, you know, which itself I think is quite critical. But I think the positive politics is still missing in those works. And I think I allude to it a little bit, and it's things that I've been focused on more so. And I think what is alluded to is a refocusing on grassroots movement building, that none of the elite level transnational campaign work matters without the commitment and the work of human beings committed in a more sincere fashion to political change, to reform, to, you know, institutional accountability, etc. And so, you know, that's why I do, I, you know, again, I share some sympathy with the structure of Amnesty International, because I think it is some attempt at that. It is an attempt at ordinary people organized around, you know, kitchen tables and church basements to organize themselves to influence politics. That being said, Amnesty's never really put any effort into true movement building on the grassroots level. And so I think that, you know, a dedication to that work and an appreciation for the other organizations that do that work. You know, movement building and organizing is not a new or novel charge. You know, obviously organized labor and in the United States, you know, the Chicano movement and others have always done organizing. It's door to door, it's face to face, it's person to person, it's through personal relationships and to borrow borrow a quote from a man named Fernando Garcia of the Border Network for Human Rights, which is a you know, human rights organization based in El Paso, Texas, that I recently did field work. You know, he talks about organizing as the development, as the transformation of personal relationships into political relationships. This is about, or it's about movement building, and it can't happen without those relationships. It can't happen through advertising. It can't happen through celebrity seduction. It can't happen through, you know, our familiar, you know, experience of all, you know, witnessing distant suffering and watching the same news, you know, having the same experience with media, you know, either social media or broadcast media. It must be more personal. It has to be more personal. And so, you know, at this moment of threat on the one hand, whether that's the rise of the right wing, the rise of surveillance, the closing of civil society space, you know, around the world, a moment for rethinking for human rights organizations. What does it mean to invigorate a public around these norms and challenge the prevailing forces that really threaten the things we believe in?